Welcome to Prophecy Radio, the Percy Jackson podcast that will keep you up to date on all things Rick Riordan and Rick Riordan Presents, including upcoming books, adaptations, and more. This is episode number 134. My name is Karen.
I'm Kristen.
And we're here. We skipped a week.
Yeah. Unavoidable.
Yeah. Karen had a book deadline.
Sometimes deadlines just have to take priority over things we love doing. So
I did finish it, though.
That's good.
So Cassie 9 is with my editor right now. This is a beast of a book. It took me so long. I've been trying to finish this book. It feels like for months. But I'm happy with how it turned out.
Good.
It took a while, but it was kind of a big book because a lot of, like, stuff is culminating and then Cassie goes into, like, a new direction in book 10. So,
yes.
It was a little bit of a beast, but I am glad that it's done, excited to see how the editor feels about it, and I get, like, a week reprieve before I have to start on the next book, which is due out in August.
Of course.
Yeah, a little bit busy, but that was the reason why we skipped last week, because I knew I was trying to be a good egg and prioritize the most important things and not feel stressed about this thing that we're doing for fun.
Yeah.
And I feel like that was the right choice.
I think it was, too.
Yeah.
It let you focus, and this will go up only a week late, so that's not too bad. It's going to happen.
Yeah.
We're people, we've got lives and jobs and stuff, and occasionally it's going to get in the way, and just keep trucking.
Speaking of lives and stuff, I feel like we didn't see each other, like, it hasn't been that long, but I feel like we were gabbing for a while, talking about stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Both planning on going on soon. I'm going to Kentucky, and you're going to Maine.
Yeah, I'm really excited about Maine. I was telling Karen all about the whale watching trip.
Yes.
It's like a 4-hour boat ride, 3 or 4 hours, and like the ship has, it's not a ship, like it's a big boat, basically. Mm-hmm. The inside of the boat has like wooden benches and it's completely enclosed. So I'm guessing you probably travel inside, like when the boat is at full speed, like getting out into the open water.
Mm-hmm.
So like there's a bunch of benches there that you can go and like sit and relax while you're waiting. But then like the whole outer deck of the ship is just like one big open area. Like there's not a lot of junk and stuff being housed there. So you can basically like wander from stem to stern on this boat watching for whales, and I'm very, very excited.
Yeah.
Because I love the ocean, and I find, like, if I had been able to choose my destiny as a child and, like, follow it through, I would have been a marine biologist.
That's cool.
I know it's so cliche for little girls to want to be marine biologists, but it's so true. Like, my brother and I were absolutely fascinated by sharks and whales, and we spent so much time watching National Geographic and Discovery and all of that stuff. Shark Week was an event for us. Like, we loved watching all the shark content. So, I'm super, super excited to hopefully see a whale for the first time in my life.
That would be really cool.
Right?
Yeah. We're going to Kentucky. There's a reptile zoo nearby, and then we're going to Red River Gorge, which is a national forest, because we both really love going to national parks and, like, all that kind of stuff. So that'll be really fun to, like, go somewhere new. We've never been there before. We've been to Kentucky before, like, right over the border when we went to Cincinnati, but this is a little bit, I think this is, like, 2 hours from Cincinnati, so a little bit further out, but I'm super excited. And I think the weather's going to be nice, so
nice.
Really excited about that.
Yeah, we're both hoping that, because we're going at the end of May, we're hoping that we'll be able to hit the warmer Maine weather.
Yeah.
By then, we're expecting it to be, like, you know, not maybe not well into summer, but, like, hitting those summer temps somewhere in the
70s. It'll be, like, probably pretty temperate, where it's, like, comfortable to be outside.
Works for me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Apparently, we're staying in Portland the majority of the trip, and apparently they are a huge foodie town, which I did not know. There is like two or three James Beard award-winning bakeries in town, which, like, wow. But we've also made a deal. My husband and I are not seafood people. Like, not dramatically. We just usually choose steak or chicken when we're out. We've both decided we're trying a lobster roll while we're there.
Yes, yeah. Do that.
It's like, we're in Maine.
Yeah.
We've got to find a lobster roll that looks good to us. He's not a big mayonnaise person, but, like, he can deal with it. Like,
yeah.
He likes, like, potato salad.
Oh, okay. I'm
like, that's mayonnaise. He goes, I know, but that's the only thing I eat mayonnaise in. Everything, any other time, it's gross. And I'm like, well.
That astounds me. I put mayonnaise, I swear, on everything. I'm a huge condiment person.
I am an aioli person.
Yeah.
Garlic aioli has become, like, something I slather on a lot of things. Yeah. But, like, actual mayo is not something I gravitate toward. But I have it on a couple of things, so it's not a deal breaker. I'm excited to try a lobster roll.
Yeah. And, I mean, you're going to a good place for it. Like,
exactly.
I've had a lobster roll in Rhode Island, and that was amazing. Like, crab cakes and stuff in Rhode Island. Chowder, very good. And I had, like, a shrimp po' boy in Louisiana, and that was, like, one of the best things I've ever eaten.
I'm not a big shrimp person, but yeah. I think it's because I've never really tried it because I've been afraid of it because I'm a texture person.
Right.
And I feel like the texture of seafood is weird.
It can be.
And that's why I haven't, but, like, oh my gosh, watching them make po' boys on, like, Top Chef, they always just look so good.
Yeah. I just, yesterday, we went out for my boyfriend's birthday, and I had a shrimp patty melt. It was just shrimp cheese and, like, two pieces of bread. Oh, my God. I keep thinking about it, and he got like, fish and chips, and he was like, wish I got the patty melt. And I was like, you know what? We just have to go back now. And
right.
He was like, yeah, and it's a limited time special at this restaurant, so, like, we got to go back soon. And
darn.
I was like, yeah. Twist my arm. We were so full because they had a deep fried Snickers, and
oh,
we were so full that we couldn't even get dessert. And I was like, we're getting that because I'm
home. Yeah. Like, so, we're going back, we're saving room for dessert, and we're having that.
Yeah.
Done.
If you want to tell us anything you might know about Maine or Kentucky, if you're from either of those states or have visited, or your love or hatred of seafood, or anything related to Percy Jackson, you can contact us at Prophecy Radio Podcast on Instagram or email us at prophecyradiopodcast@gmail.com. We do have a little bit of news this week.
There was one thing I forgot.
Yes.
When we were talking about anything to add to the news, and I didn't tell you, and it's my fault.
Okay.
There was one little thing that I wanted to bring up. Coming up on Saturday, April 26th, is Independent Bookstore Day.
Ooh.
It has been on that date or that time of year, like the third or fourth weekend in April, for a long time. And Amazon has scheduled a book sale for the same day, and they did it on purpose. So, if you want to truly back the independent writers in your life, the indie publishers, all of that, as much as we all use Amazon, because it's impossible not to in our world
very
these
convenient.
Days, I've tried to cut down on some of it, but I get it. It's, you know, as much as we you know, kind of have to use it for some things, definitely give it a thought. Maybe pick an independent bookstore near you and go out and celebrate Independent Bookstore Day, because it's a worthy cause, and there's a lot of great independent bookstores that do more than just sell books. They have events, and they have authors, and they have signings, or even just, like, book readings with, you know, or, like, silent book clubs where you just go and sit with people and read your books silently.
Yeah.
And, like, stuff like that. There's so many things at independent bookstores.
Yeah.
So, something to keep in mind. I just read something about this morning, and it was getting me so mad.
Mm.
Like, Amazon's never done it before, but now it's like they're really picking on those indie bookstores and trying to put them out of business. So give it a thought.
Yeah. That's super unfortunate. I wonder, because that's when I'm going to be away, so maybe I'll find a
Right, maybe bookstore. You'll find a cute one to visit while you're there.
We're not going to be that far from Lexington, so, I mean,
yeah.
I'm sure there's something there. And, I mean, always shop local when you can, but a lot of the, like, bigger, like, independent bookstores and stuff, like, they will ship those books. Like, I've ordered books from, like,
so many.
The one in Georgia that, like, Roshni always has her books at and stuff. Like, I've bought, like, signed copies from there before. So, like, you can support independent bookstores related to authors that you love. Like, support their independent bookstore.
And also, if just generally benefiting independent bookstores is important to you, bookshop.org.
Yes.
You can buy from a central website any book you're looking for. Like, you can search through independent bookstores, basically. But your purchase, like, I think it's like 10% of your purchase goes back to independent bookstores as well. I may or may not have just bought all 8 books of the Kate Canterbury's Walsh series. Oh. They're putting out a 10th anniversary edition. Ooh. Because it's been 10 years.
Okay.
She just released them like 2 days ago.
I'll have to check those out because I have read the first few of those.
Yes. She just released them like 2 days ago, and I may have impulse bought them, but I bought them from bookshop.org, and so I'm very excited to have contributed and done my part to kind of
help.
Yeah.
That's really awesome. Yeah. And they usually have some like good sales and like
Their prices
are pretty comparable, so...
Yeah, I mean, it's not necessarily, like, a discount site, so don't go to it looking for that. But, like, if there's a book you want that you're, you know, willing to just pay the price for, you know, definitely look at bookshop.org, because it's not going to be any more than it would be anywhere else.
Yeah.
Like, if you go to Barnes & Noble, honest to God, there's not usually that many sales. It's more or less just, like... you're going to buy the book.
Yeah.
And so you're going to pay cover price for most things, you know. So books are one of those weird things that unless it's a special sale during the year, like, more often than not, they don't really go on sale. I think that's why Amazon's made as much money as they have, is because they mark books down all the time.
Yeah.
But it's like, eh, sometimes it's worth it.
Yeah.
But no, they do have sales and stuff on bookshop.org and good prices on things.
Yeah.
I've seen a lot of competitive pricing.
Yeah, I've definitely bought some from there where, like, it was pretty cheap. Like, they went on, like, super sale and stuff just to get rid of stock, and that's always fun because you get a little present.
Right?
Yeah.
So, give it a thought.
Yeah.
Just wanted to mention that because it's close to my heart.
Yeah, definitely. I think all of our listeners will really appreciate that information, and I'll have to remember to check that out when I'm out and about.
Yeah.
So, just a few small pieces of news, all of which are related to Percy Jackson and the Olympians on Disney Plus. The first one is, I hope everybody got to see Rick unboxing his Emmys on Instagram, because it was just so delightful. It was just such a dad vibe, to be perfectly honest. I pulled 2 quotes from the video because I couldn't help myself. That's a high quality box, he says. And also, boy, that is a substantial piece of hardware when he's talking about the actual Emmy.
Oh, Rick.
And it's just like, I mean, dad vibes, like, all the time. And I love it. And what I really loved, both him and Becky, when they were posting about the Emmys and everything, like, immediately just thinking the cast and crew. Like, I feel like he came up with this story and he had such a big part in it, but I feel like he really takes himself out of the equation when he talks about the show, because he's always like, couldn't do it without everybody else. And it's like, they couldn't do it without you either there, buddy.
Right.
But, I mean, I love how appreciative he is of everybody who's put in the hard work.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, that's on his Instagram. Go check it out. It was really cute. And I guess, like, a little bit of sad news, but, like, not that sad. I think it'll be okay. Jay Duplass will not return as Hades in season 2, but that's just because Hades isn't in season 2. And he, I'll link to the article, but he says in there, I am not in season 2, but there has been some potential droppings about season 3, which would make sense a little bit. And so that's pretty exciting. And he also went on to say, I love being a part of the show. It's the first show I've ever been in that my kids can watch. It's not just that my kids can watch it. Percy Jackson is literally my children's favorite piece of art ever, the book series. And so I feel like if they need Hades to come back, Jay is going to come back as Hades. Like, it's not, you know, he's not uninterested in coming back. It's just that there was no room for Hades in season 2.
Yeah. Makes sense.
Yeah.
I mean, with where that story is and, yeah, with the significant role that Ares plays in that book, there's just not a lot of room for Hades' story. But we all know that season 3 has been greenlit.
Right.
And we know that Nico is, like, center stage. So there's definitely way more room to play with Hades.
And I bet, like, as we learn, like, who Nico is and what's going on with him, although I don't know if we don't know that until the end of book 3, I don't think, like, what's actually going on with him, because I think that's, like, how book 3 ends.
But I'm curious how this show will kind of,
because with, like,
that.
Flashbacks and stuff, we know there's talk of, like, they could very easily work in flashbacks of Hades and Nico's mom and, like, Bianca and all of that, so.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think that'll be really good. Mm-hmm. So I'm not too worried about it. I mean, I liked Hades in season 1, but like you said, we're probably going to get a lot of Ares. We know we're going to get more Hermes, and I would rather focus on them for the sake of the story than, like, shoehorning somebody else in.
Exactly, yeah. And, like, they did expanding Percy's story and, like, the story with his mom and the flashbacks with him in season 1. I'm very excited to see what they do with some of the other kids and their godly parents in season 2, especially with Clarice, because we know that that's kind of central to the bigger story in book 2. So yeah, very, very excited to see how all of the magic of TV lets us play with extra things that we didn't necessarily have in the book, because you're following Percy, you're following, you know, Clarice, and you're seeing the story kind of play out. So. Yeah.
There's another piece of news that I don't think we talked about before, but neither one of us could 100% remember, so we're just going to talk about it again anyway. At D23 2024, which I believe was, like, in August.
I think so.
Disney announced the casting of the Grey Sisters, 3 women that Percy and Annabeth meet in Chapter 3 of Riordan's book, We Hail the Taxi of Eternal Torment. The trio will be portrayed by Sandra Bernhard, who will be Anger, Kristen Schaal, who will be Tempest, and Margaret Cho, who is Wasp. And Sandra Bernhard, I know from Roseanne, which I'm not 100%. She's been in, like, a bajillion million things, and I know I saw her in something more recently, but couldn't for the life of me find it.
Mm.
But she was Nancy on Roseanne, and I definitely remember her there. Given our age, and perhaps the age of our listeners, maybe a lot of people will get that reference. But if you're a little bit younger, maybe Roseanne was a little bit in the past.
Well, and apparently I have not currently been watching it, but she's in Severance.
Yeah.
Which is very popular. So if you've been watching Severance, you've seen her. I know I've seen her in things.
She's got a very recognizable face, I feel like.
But, yeah, nothing is standing out. I was not a huge Roseanne person in my youth.
Oh, wow.
Hi, Kelly.
Did you like Roseanne? You weren't live for Roseanne.
Big fan.
Yeah. The window's open, and I feel like she's got a little bit of that spring energy.
So she's making her presence known.
Yeah.
I know I've definitely seen her in things, but nothing is jumping out at me from her filmography at the moment.
Yeah.
But very capable, very excited.
Kristen, is it Schaal or Schaal?
I think it's Schaal.
Schaal, okay. S-C-H-A-A-L. She's the guide on What We Do in the Shadows. She's very good on there. Very funny. Like her a lot. She's also been in various other things.
A million things.
Yeah. She's a great actress.
Mm-hmm.
And then Margaret Cho has also been in a bunch of things, but I know her best, like, as a comedian.
I was gonna say, a lot of people know her for her stand-up.
I think those are 3 very good names to have attached to the show, and very excited to see how they bring these characters to life.
And all very, very comfortable with comedy.
Yes.
Which is fun, because, like, we saw how serious we took a lot of season 1 with, like, the gods and, you know, whatever. Like, there were definitely some lighter moments, but especially with the kids.
Mm-hmm.
I am intrigued that they have hired 3 actresses who are very, very comfortable with comedy. So, as much as, like, the Grey Sisters are kind of a little bit creepy and scary, like, they're definitely leaning toward a comedic angle here, too.
Which I think is, like, the right call, like, that dynamic, that juxtaposition of, like, okay, these are kind of creepy people, but also, like, kind of ridiculous. Which is what Rick does really well with, like, you're afraid of the gods, but also they're...
Look at them, they're so ridiculous.
And, like, unhinged, and
Yeah, so I'm excited to see what they do with all that.
Yeah, I think it'll be really great, and we only have to wait until December for the show, so... So I'm very excited about that. We should definitely do a rewatch at some point.
Yes.
I think that would be really fun.
Definitely.
Okay, so we are getting back into the Red Pyramid for the first time in a while. If you didn't listen to last time's episode, we did a little catch up on everything. And so we are jumping into chapters 23 and 24 now. And they were a bit
thick.
Yeah, they had some meat to their bones.
For sure. I will say chapter 23 is one heck of a chapter. So much information in it. It's a very dense chapter, and I think that's the majority of why it feels so long, is there's a lot of information being communicated in chapter 23. We're going to dive right in here. I will try and keep this moving right along, but again, it's a lot of information, so just bear with us. Sadie's human again. Ta-da! This chapter is from Sadie's point of view, and one of the first things she does is we get an introduction. We get Carter talking to her, and she speaks, and Carter's like, "You're human again." Like, so we get that clarification. Like, right. She has made it out of kite form and is now back to being human. And she kind of gives us a little bit of an aside, like talking about how she was able to become human again. It's like she was focusing on that feeling of like being with her mom and that dream of being with her mom again, even though she knows it's like not possible.
Yeah.
That feeling was enough to kind of be able to let her get back into her human form.
Yeah. She specifically says like it reminded me who I was, and that's when I was able to like get back into human form, which I thought was really sweet.
Yeah. I did too. Okay, so nobody woke Carter for lunch on the plane. He slept through all of that, which I thought was hilarious. Carter gets right to letting them all know about Seth's plan. He kind of skips his devastation over lunch and like moves right into letting them know what's going on. He also lays really deep on how close his Ba came to being captured by Seth, because that feels significant. Bast is pretty concerned about Seth's plans. She specifically says that this blast of storm magic being done at dawn, which is a specifically important time for magicians and for magic, could be devastating, and it would leave Set with nothing to rule over, and his goal is to like rule.
Yeah.
So she's kind of concerned that this is not Set's plan, it's someone else's plan. And when Carter like relays that there's a simple demon that is like really the planner behind all of this, she seems especially plagued by that idea.
Yeah, I thought that this little exchange was really interesting and kind of hints at like, okay, maybe something bigger is at play here. Maybe not everything is as it seems, which is like one of my favorite themes in Rick's books and in mythology in general, because I feel like this idea that like the bad guys of mythology aren't always evil, they're just like playing their role in the game. Like, you know, we think of Hades, and especially like with the Disney Hercules movie, like Hades
Definitely.
Is the bad guy, he is the villain, and like I love that for him in that movie, but that's just because Hades dealt with death and the underworld and everything. He was actually very well respected and was, as we've talked about extensively, one of the better gods in the pantheon of Greek mythology.
Especially standing next to Zeus.
Yeah, exactly. And Set is a trickster god like Loki, which, you know, I think everybody these days is kind of familiar with at least Marvel's version of Loki.
Yeah.
And, you know, that him being a trickster is like, it's just his nature. And I really liked that Bast is like, I don't know, like, this doesn't sound like him. I think there might be something going on, but she's not ready to tell the kids yet.
Right. Yeah. Just the idea that there's a quote unquote simple demon who's helping plan this.
Mm-hmm.
You can see the cogs working in her head. Like, I don't know who he's talking about, but I have a list, and I'm going to run through the list before I start accusing people or, you know, coming up with ideas to tell the kids. Like, clearly Bast is running through the options of who is actually putting this all in motion. It's pretty clear that, like, Set while seems to be on board for a lot of it, is not the driving force.
Yeah.
So basically, it's time to ask Thoth what's going on and what he can help them with. So we get through the flight and they land in Memphis and we find out that Thoth and Bast don't get along very well. So she says, I'm going to peace out. You guys are going to go see Thoth and I'll come find you when it comes time for that. They do not steal a car this time. They
borrowed it.
They rented a convertible because Bast wanted a convertible, so that's what you get. They talk all about Memphis, and there's a lot of description about the style of Memphis. I don't know if it's, like, important to the story, but it's very poetic and very
great. Yeah, I don't think it's important necessarily, but I feel like with this book in particular, Rick is putting a lot of emphasis on like American culture in a way that like we didn't really get with Percy. And I feel like we got a little bit of that in Magnus too, in terms of like Boston and the homeless kids and like just what that life is like.
Yeah.
And especially with Carter being very noticeably black, I think that like him doing this service of like what Memphis is like and what you might see as you stroll through Memphis, like, I thought it was really cool that he added it in here. It gives you a little bit more atmosphere.
Yeah, like, especially some of the juxtaposition of, like, these really old, like, Gone with the Wind, huge houses, yeah. And then you've got, like, Santa on the roof, and, like, yeah. Stuff like that. Like, it feels big and otherworldly, but it's also very just everyday mm-hmm. in the same time.
I also think it's important to remember that this chapter is from Sadie's point of view, and she grew up in London.
Correct.
So, like, this is stuff that she would be like, this is weird.
Yeah.
This, like, I'm kind of taking in a whole new culture for the first time. And yeah. Because I remember, like, when the old lady almost hits him, she kind of makes a joke about, like, Southern hospitality. And I'm like, yeah, like, Sadie doesn't know really anything about, like, American yeah. culture and Southern culture and stuff. So these are the details that she would definitely notice.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I think it does. It sets the atmosphere, but it's all just, like, it is a little different and worth noting that Rick has made a point to kind of really highlight the Americana of this area yeah. of the country. Carter asks where Thoth is. Like, where are we going to find this guy? And Bast uses her cat-like abilities and is sniffing the air, which I just found hilarious. But then goes on to talk about how Thoth almost always chooses a center of learning. And Sadie sees signs for the University of Memphis, and that seems like a no-brainer. So they head to the university, and they're kind of wandering around aimlessly. I think Bast is still sniffing, trying to get scent of Thoth. And they come across a group of baboons playing basketball. Seems like a no-brainer that this might be a sign that a god is nearby.
Yeah.
The baboon is the sacred animal of Thoth, so it makes total sense that they would be nearby. So yes, they are close. Khufu is one of the baboons playing basketball in his Lakers jersey, and so he bounds over to see the kids when he realizes they're there. We find out that Bast speaks baboon.
This was so funny to me. Like, the single grunt to convey, like, multiple sentences in English. I was dying. It was so funny.
It's so funny because it's kind of hard to convey in book form. Like, this is the kind of thing that if we ever get a Red Pyramid movie, we'll yeah. come across as so funny. But, like, that whole, like, Carter's giving you an entire sentence, a whole thought, and then Bast looks at him and goes, ah.
Yeah.
And, like, I can just feel how funny, like, you know, how funny that would be on screen in a scene. Like,
yeah.
And Carter's like, that's it? Like he doesn't say it, but he's just, like, staring at her like, that's all we got. Okay, all right. That's baboon. Got it. But, yes, Bast speaks baboon and so is able to translate for Khufu, which is hilarious. The things that we learn here, Khufu thinks that they smell like flamingos, specifically Sadie, and Sadie points out that that's kite you're smelling, that is not flamingo. Do not.
Please do not eat me.
Right? Like, also, yeah, please don't eat me. We also find out how Khufu survived the whole mansion crash thing that happened way back when, because it feels like a million years ago.
It wasn't at this point.
Khufu dove into the river and eventually made his way back to the mansion, but it was destroyed. Khufu waited at the mansion a couple of days for Amos, and when Amos didn't show, Khufu reached out, like, found Thoth, and has been hanging with Thoth and the baboons that hang out with Thoth for a while now. Baboons are very wise creatures. Bast makes it clear that they're not as smart as cats, but they do pretty well for themselves. And that's why they are considered, like, one of Thoth's sacred animals, or the sacred animal for him. Khufu is going to take the kids to the professor, as they call Thoth, but he will only do so after Carter shows his basketball skills and keeps the promise that he made to Khufu. So, we get to see Carter's skills. And let me tell you, he is not particularly gifted.
No.
No. He trips over his shoes, he catches a pass with his forehead, he dribbles with both hands, like he's quote-unquote petting a possibly rabid dog. Sadie is so sweet here. Like, she's being vicious in her description of how he plays this game, but when it actually comes to, like, being a sister, it could go one of two ways.
Right.
And she keeps it on the nicer path.
Yeah, which is very unlike Sadie, but I think this book does such a great job of giving you, like, this slow, this feels weird to say slow burn, but I do kind of feel like that's what it is, like, friendship between these two siblings.
Like, they're figuring out how to be siblings because they've only seen each other 2 days a year up until now, and now it's like, oh, we actually have to, like, bond and talk and spend time. And
these little moments where they find empathy for each other, like, speak volumes, I think.
So the baboons literally are running circles around Carter, and eventually he just falls over on the court. And the baboons are perplexed, and we kind of find out why, even though Carter is not particularly talented, why he puts so much focus on basketball. It's because it's Julius, it's their dad's favorite game. And Carter has, because he's not particularly physically gifted, has made it a point to be really good with, like, basketball stats and learning all of that side of the game. He's just not particularly skilled. But he does fulfill his promise, and he shows his skills, even though Khufu and the other baboons are not impressed. Khufu does also hold up his end of the bargain and takes them to Thoth. Thoth is hiding kind of in a deserted science building on campus. There's a whole lineup of professors' offices right there, and they pass one that's particularly small. Carter kind of talks about it being the size of a room closet. And so when they open the door to Thoth's office, they expect it to be pretty small too. Instead, it's this massive, 10-meter high, because we're in Sadie's point of view, we get meters. Also, another note for that.
Yeah.
It's a 10-meter high ceiling, and, like, there's a loft with a telescope in it, and, like, it's a huge office. Someone is upstairs strumming a guitar in the loft, and we pretty quickly learn that that is Thoth. But, like, the walls are just covered in books, as you would expect. Work tables kind of litter the space full of bits and bobs and abandoned projects and things like that as well. Also worth noting, the room apparently smells of cooked beef. I don't know why it's a detail we needed to know, but I'm just passing it along. In the room, six long-necked ibises who are typing with their beaks at desks. They're described as receptionists, but what they really, I mean, they're basically just, like, transcribing Thoth's words, which we learn once they start talking to Thoth here in a moment. Khufu gets Thoth's attention, and we finally see Thoth and get a physical description of the god. So, he is a lanky man in his 20s, with an unruly mane of blonde hair, wearing a stained lab coat over faded jeans and a black t-shirt. He's definitely a little odd. The first things he says are that he tells Khufu he's discovered that they aren't in Memphis, Egypt. And that he's also discovered blues music and barbecue, mm-hmm. and he's just in love. And it's just a very...
He's definitely that, like, stereotype of the kind of, like, genius, absent-minded professor.
Almost like that tech bro who's kind of out... Not tech bro, but, like, he's got that mentality of, like, I can't be bothered with all this other stuff because I am focused on my passion.
Yeah.
Kind of that mentality. Yeah. So when Thoth sees the kids, he slides down the banister, and the first thing he says is that, is he addresses Isis and Horus and says, like, I see you guys have found bodies to inhabit. And he definitely thinks that Sadie and Carter are not in control, that they are being, that he, when he speaks, he's speaking to the gods. And pretty quickly, Sadie insists that, no, I am in control here, Isis is not. And when she addresses Thoth, but addresses him as if she doesn't know him, he seems a little taken aback. Mm-hmm. More or less, like, shocked that Sadie is capable of being in control of a body that Isis is inhabiting. Because she's very powerful. We find the ancient Egyptian name for Thoth, which is Jehudi. The Greeks called him Thoth, which is why that name prevailed and makes some sense.
Yeah.
The Greeks confused Thoth with Hermes and renamed his city Hermopolis.
Mm-hmm. Which is really interesting because from what we're seeing, like, they're not all that similar, but, like, I also get why the Greeks would make that connection with Thoth.
Yes, and it also, like, because we have read Rick's Greek books, I thought it was interesting that he kind of includes this relation that the Greek and the Egyptian kind of gods have to each other.
Right.
Since they're in a similar region of the world, it makes sense that they would interact.
Yeah, like, yeah. And when we did, like, some of our, like, historical stuff, we saw just how much the Greeks and the Egyptians actually did interact and influence each other.
Right, absolutely. So it while Hermes and Thoth are different, you can see some of the similarities and why they would be kind of compared to each other. So yes, we learn that the Ibises are typing Thoth's scholarly essays, including one entitled A Short Treatise on the Evolution of Yaks. In pure Rick fashion, those details are delightful.
Yeah.
Thoth plans to open a new building on campus because majors like astrology and leechcraft are not offered, and that's just ridiculous. How dare you? Carter tries to bring things back on topic, and he lets Thoth know that they are looking for help to defeat Set. The minute he says that, asks for Thoth's help, all of the Ibises in the room stop typing and look directly at them, which had to have been just creepy.
Yeah, I would have been terrified. I do not love birds.
No, definitely not. And Thoth just says, you have the nerve to ask this after last time? And that moment just, because we know a bit of what happened, but, like, not this particular story.
Right.
It's a little bit taken aback, like, okay, all right, we need some information here for sure. We get some observations from Sadie about Thoth here that I thought were important. I didn't want to just completely chuck them out. Thoth tosses his grocery list out of his pocket, and when it hits the floor, the items on the list are produced from the literal words on the paper. It's just one of those qualities of Thoth, and I wanted to make sure to highlight, like, just how powerful he really is. Because he's not thinking about the magic that is needed to produce those things, and they just happen.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the stains that Sadie sees on the coat sleeves, on the lab coat sleeves, are smeared words, and they're in all kinds of different languages. The stains move and change, like, as they're standing there looking at him, and it's kind of, like, odd and off-putting. At one point, Thoth brushes a stain off of his lapel, and the letters flutter to the ground, form the word crawfish, and a crawfish morphs into being and then is eaten by an ibis. Like, it's just so kind of nuts to think that a god is so powerful that the words that exist in his orbit can literally become the embodiment of the word that's there.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, it's just this oozing of power that a word falls off his jacket and it becomes a crayfish. Like, that's interesting. Okay, so then Thoth tells them the story of last time, very briefly, so we'll keep it just as brief. Horus challenged Set to a duel to avenge Osiris. Horus won, but without Thoth's help, both Isis and Horus would have died, and the battle would have probably destroyed the world. Isis then, as they're kind of relating the story, Isis speaks in Sadie's head, and Thoth answers Isis as if he heard her speak loud and clear. I thought that was interesting. I'm curious if this is a Thoth gift or if this is a God's gift. Like, if they are standing in front of Set having a conversation and Isis wants to talk to him, can she? Or is this like a Thoth thing?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think, like, Bast, I don't think has said anything
true
about, like, Isis or Horus or anything like that. But, I mean, I could kind of see this being a wisdom thing. Like, he just knows, like, he can kind of get into, like, their minds and stuff like that. Thoth is so interesting to me because, like you were saying, he's really powerful, and yet he's also, like, really scatterbrained. He's also kind of obsessed with, like, the past in terms of, like, oh, there are no majors for astrology or, like, leechcraft. And he's like, I've discovered we're not in Egypt and stuff
right?
like that.
Yeah.
It's like, you would kind of think the god of wisdom would be very present, like, almost like Athena, you know, where, like, she is kind of one of the few gods who's, like, kind of gets it and kind of, like, understands the demigods in a way that, like, Zeus or something wouldn't, because she's so intelligent that she's very observant and understands those things, whereas Thoth is, like, so absent-minded that, like, he's not really, like, in the present moment a lot.
Yeah, I think there's also this kind of assimilation of, like, wisdom and, like, being organized and having your mind organized, as being able to access your own knowledge and your own wisdom is part of being a wise person, is, like, you have constant access to all the learning and things you have. Thoth does not seem to have a well-controlled, like, grasp on any of it. It's literally just, like, popping out of him and off of him at all times. Whereas you're right, with Athena, it just feels like she has command of herself so strongly that she can call up whatever knowledge or wisdom she needs at a moment and can give it to you.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Thoth is, like, just...
it's just chaos.
Messy.
Yeah.
It's very...
I really love the difference there.
Yeah. Very cool. Very cool. So we're getting this story. Set stabbed Horus's eye out during that battle, and Thoth replaced it with a new eye made of moonlight, which we now know as the Eye of Horus. During this battle, again, Horus cut off Isis's head, and she was healed by Thoth, which is the only reason that she is alive. She was trying to stop Horus from charging Set while he was still weak, and as she tried to stop him, she got beheaded for her trouble, and it's only because of Thoth that either one of them is alive and whole to be inhabiting the kids now. Thoth can sense that Sadie is trying to control Isis. Now that he's paying more attention, he gets that sense that she's trying to be in control, but he is insistent that Isis is too powerful, too much of a goddess to be able to be contained for long. I'm curious if this is just setting up how powerful Sadie actually is. We haven't seen either of the kids have full control of their own magic yet. They've been leaning on the gods that are inside of them to kind of guide their magic so far. I'm curious if we're going to get a demonstration of individually how powerful they are.
Right.
Because, like, yeah, Sadie hasn't... she hasn't had an easy time of controlling Isis so far, but she also hasn't been, like, constantly riddled with pushing her back.
Yeah.
Like, it's kind of a well-balanced battle at this point, and I'm interested to see how, as that goes on, how she continues to balance that. Isis is the reason that Set lost control that first time. She wanted Osiris to be king, and wanted more power, so she collected Ra's drool, mixed it with clay to make a poisonous snake.
Venomous snake.
Venomous? I'm sorry.
That's actually, I think I've talked about this before, like the one thing that Rick gets wrong is he says poisonous snake.
You're right, because I think I pulled this like right from the page,
yeah,
and it said poisonous, but you're right.
I don't remember clocking that on the page, which is funny. I think because I was so distracted, because I was like, well, what kind of snake? You can't just say snake. I mean, there's a lot of different kinds of snakes. Mm-hmm. So I looked it up, and like, I'm pretty sure they're talking about specifically a cobra.
Which makes
so
sense.
So this is like the first cobra to ever exist.
Makes sense.
Immediately, like, to Kevin, I was like, hey, did you know that this is how the Egyptians think that cobras, like, were created?
It's important that you might want to know.
Yeah.
But the cobra, the venomous snake, bit Ra and he almost died. She then told Ra the only way to save him was for him to tell her his secret name, which we get this concept of secret names having very specific power,
yeah,
and knowing the secret name for things gives you power over them.
This is a concept in literature that I have always been obsessed with. It's like a huge thing with fairies too.
Yes.
Like that is like, if you know the fairy's like actual name, then you can control it. Or like demons, you can summon demons if you know their actual name, control them, that sort of thing. And I've always been obsessed with, like, names, the meaning of names. When I first started writing, I was just talking about this the other day. When I first started writing, I would pick every single name on purpose. So it would have a meaning or, like, maybe hint at, like, the future of that character in the story. After you've written 20-plus books, you realize, I mean, there's a lot of names in the world, but it gets to be a little much. And sometimes my names are on purpose, and other times I'm like, I haven't had a Steve in my book yet. This character's name is Steve.
I mean, it makes sense. Like, there are characters where you want the names to be significant for this reason or that reason. Or if you're writing fantasy, names sometimes have a stronger pull. Whereas if you're writing a different genre, something more contemporary, the name might be a fun anecdote. Like, it might be a fun thing related to the character, but, like, it doesn't have to be.
Yeah.
It can just be a name.
And names can, like, give the right vibe of a person. Like, a lot of the times when I'm thinking about character names, it's like, well, is this, like, an old stuffy person? Okay, like, their name's gonna be something that's, like,
Mildred.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, exactly. Something like that. Or, like, if it's a very young person, like, you know, it could be a more contemporary name. And, like,
yeah,
a name can really tell you a lot about a person, so I do love this concept.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I can't say I didn't immediately think about the dragons in Fourth Wing and how their names are secret. Like, they give them shorter versions of their name that everyone knows them by, but their full names are kept private to the writer specifically. And I feel like there's a reason for that. And I can't wait to find out the reason why all the names are secret. Like, there's gotta be a point to this.
Yeah.
Anyway. So yeah, that's immediately where my brain went. But Isis insisted that if she knew Ra's secret name, she could heal him. And she was able to heal him once she learned his secret name, but that also gave her power over Ra, which was kind of the point of the whole exercise. This made Set and Osiris enemies, as Set was an important lieutenant to Ra and didn't like how everything went down and everything that went down between Isis and Ra and
Which is
Osiris.
So interesting, because in this story, Isis is the bad guy, and Set is a loyal soldier, and yet the current story we're reading that's actually happening to the Kanes is that Set is the villain, and it's very interesting to see how those things can change depending on the story, the moment, the points of view, who's telling it, you know.
The motivation.
Yeah.
Like, Isis's motivation in this story is, I want more power for Osiris, so I'm going to do this. And you can see why Set would react badly to the situation. But now, with what we're looking at, the players are set up in such a way that Set is the antagonist here.
Mm-hmm.
We just have to figure out why and how and, like, all the extra details to figure out if it's...
And if he actually is the antagonist or just another little soldier.
Or is there someone else pulling all the little strings? Yes, of course. Thoth is kind of making a point and points out that Sadie would do anything to save her family, even if it upset the balance of the cosmos. And Sadie kind of has a moment where she has, like, she says, of course, yes, I would do anything to save my family. And she says it to herself, and she's not able to tell who answered that accusation, whether it was her or Isis. And I think those little brief moments of fear are what keeps Sadie powerful enough to hold Isis at bay. Like, I think it's just she has not yet tapped into her own magic, and so being able to keep her at bay is, like, important enough that when she has those little moments of fear, it like, charges her up to be able to keep Isis at bay.
I wonder, this is really interesting to me, considering how much difficulty she had turning back from a kite, because you would think if she struggled to remember who she was when she was in bird form, why is she... I mean, she's obviously struggling here, but not to the point where she's, like, letting Isis take control. So, like, what is the difference there? Or does that, like... I mean, I think Rick always writes very intentionally, and he very rarely makes, like, you know, big plot hole mistakes. But yeah. I wonder if, like, those two things are kind of at odds with each other. The yeah. fact that she struggles with turning back from a bird, but can hold a goddess at bay.
I wonder if that may have something to do with, like, since the changing out of forms has to do with your knowledge of your sense of self, like, it doesn't negate how powerful a magician Sadie can be and the power at her fingertips, but, like, because she has been raised by grandparents who didn't care to educate her on her history and didn't want her knowing about it, maybe that's giving her a bit of a disconnect with who she really is, and so that's makes it harder to flit in and out of different beings, like being kite form versus right. human form and stuff yeah. like that. That is interesting, though. Like, you're right. Like, that does kind of push against each other in your head. Like, how can these two things be true at the same time?
Yeah.
Sadie tells Thoth that she is in control and proceeds to tell him what's been going on with Set and her father. She kind of changes the subject. Like, okay, I'm in control. Let's keep moving. Carter hands Thoth the book that they stole in Paris, the one that details how to defeat Set. Thoth just, as he's handed this book, starts reading through it, and he basically just wants to line edit his old work. Like,
I felt this on such a deep level. I love that. Same.
I read some of those articles I read my first year at Hypable, and I'm like, oh my gosh, I was terrible at yeah. this. Why did they hire me? Like,
yeah.
It is a writer's thing that you look back at old pieces of work and you're like, what was I thinking? I could do so much better with this now. And I love that they included this for Thoth.
Yeah.
Carter begs Thoth to help them defeat Set and save the millions of people that will probably be killed if this whole event goes on uninhibited. Thoth asks Carter why he thinks Julius put him in this position in the first place. Why would Julius release the gods? Like, why is that the answer? And Carter goes on to kind of talk about how... I don't think Carter actually says any of this out loud. He's, like, thinking it. But he's talking about how he thinks their mom saw what was coming, saw that it was bad, and that releasing the gods is the only option to getting to this point. And that's really the only part of it I think he's really sharing here, is, like, something bad is coming, and the only option was to release the gods. It's not necessarily a good option, but it was the only one that his dad saw. And so that is why Julius went through with what he did at the museum and why he released them. This line from Carter, he says, "Gods have great power, but only humans have creativity." And that's why releasing the gods was, like, the key to this, is you need the human's creativity to use the god's power in a way that will make this situation work, but you can't do it without the gods there to begin with. They're talking a little bit about their mom, and the mom must have convinced Iskandar that the rule about releasing the gods was wrong. It's the only way that this all could have gone, played out the way it has so far. Isis would never admit that she doesn't know something. Mm-hmm. Like, Thoth sees that, and that's when he agrees that Sadie is definitely in control. Yeah. And
that was really funny.
I mean, it's true, though.
Yeah.
Especially when you've just had this whole story about Isis, like, manipulating the gods to get what she wants. Like, I can see why that would be.
And I mean, the gods in general, even what we know from Percy Jackson, like, they do not like to admit when they're wrong, or, you know, that their motivations are bad and stuff like that. So, like, yeah, this is just kind of a god thing to do.
Yeah. So now Thoth wants to test that these two truly have the control that they're kind of showing him. And he says he wants them to bring him an item from a nearby magician's tomb. And he grabs a piece of chalk from his lab coat pocket, scribbles with it in the air. A doorway appears. He says, if you succeed, we'll have barbecue. And then poof, the doorway pulls Carter and Sadie into a black void and they're gone. This chapter was a lot.
It was, yeah.
And some of it, my brain has trouble wrapping it around. So if you have questions about some of the stuff in this chapter, feel free to let us know. And we can definitely talk about it on the next one and just clear up any chaos. Because there's just a lot of information that came out of this one.
Yeah, I'm kind of surprised that he didn't cut the chapter into, like, the pre-meeting Thoth and then the whole Thoth meeting.
Right.
Because I feel like he very easily could have done that.
And I feel like it would have made it a little easier to just imbibe the whole...
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's all good. We made it through. So now we have to do favorite lines and favorite moments. Karen, what was yours?
Mine was Carter's reaction to hearing the story about how Horus cut off Isis's head. And he goes, hold up. Carter glanced at me. I cut off her head. I got better, Isis assured me. That was, I love the little, like, snarkiness between them and, like, Isis, even though she clearly is, like, a little bit of a manipulative person. She's got this spunky personality that really suits Sadie, I think. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of cool to get some of her lines inside Sadie's head.
Definitely. Mine was Sadie, as they were talking about the secret name thing, and Sadie goes, secret name, like Bruce Wayne. And I just love that, because, yes, it's exactly like Bruce Wayne. Not at all, but it's exactly like Bruce Wayne. What was your favorite moment?
Mine was Sadie choosing not to pick on Carter for how terrible he is at basketball, because, I mean, that was easy pickings right there. Like, he was not just, like... not good. He was hilariously terrible. And she kind of understands, oh, he's obsessed with basketball because our dad's obsessed with basketball and he's just trying to, like, live up to his dad and all that kind of stuff. And the fact that she can, like, empathize with that and then chooses not to go for the easy jokes, I feel like not only tells us how far they've come in their relationship, but also, like, how much she's matured in a short amount of time.
Absolutely. I also agree. I think it's such a cute little added moment, because let's face it, him and his basketball skills are not a very important part of this chapter,
yeah.
But watching the two of them kind of interact through that moment and her not choosing not to pick at that is telling. It's proving just how much Sadie is starting to really value Carter and not wanting to dig at that very... You can tell it's a little bit of a tender bit,
yeah.
You know? Like, Carter is not going to take it well if people can, you know, poke at him too hard about that, because he might not be skilled at it, but again, yeah, it's something very precious to him because it's a connection he has with his dad and something that they bond over. So, yeah. I really liked that moment, too. Mine is kind of hilarious because it's kind of the other side of that coin. I kind of loved the fact that they didn't wake Carter on the plane for meals, because it's almost like the other side of the sibling coin. Like, you don't... Like, she was hungry. She ate lunch. She didn't really want to wake Carter because he might have eaten more than she, you know, wanted to let him. And so it's kind of that playful side of their relationship at the same time. Like... There's just a little bit of, it's two sides of that sibling coin, and I liked that we kind of got both in that chapter. Okay, so now it is time for chapter 24, and we're just going to try and blow through this, because this one's a little more active. So I feel like this chapter moves a little quicker than the last. It's entitled, I Blow Up Some Blue Suede Shoes. So when Carter and Sadie, when we see them next after this black portal kind of sucks them through, they are standing outside a big estate with these gates that have, like, musicians and guitars kind of on them. And Carter knows instantly that they are at Graceland. He's been there before. His dad's brought him there before. His dad had symposiums nearby, and Carter spent some time at Graceland by himself. Thoth has asked them to steal something from a magician's tomb, and so naturally, Sadie asks the question, wait, Elvis was a magician? And all signs point to yes, which is good fun, and it's one of those Rick classic moments where he takes a pop culture figure and just inserts them into his book and says, yep, they were a magician.
And I love that it wasn't necessarily just there for the funny haha moment, because they specifically talk about how music is a form of magic. And if you think about how important music is in, like, human culture across the board, it doesn't matter where you're from, music plays a huge part in a lot of people's lives. It does kind of feel like magic sometimes. The way it could bring you together, the way that it makes you feel, you know, how it helps you emote through, like, a breakup, or, like, makes you happy when you're sad, and, like, all that kind of stuff. So I thought that was really clever, the way that he did that.
It really is, and it's very true, all the things, like, especially with your emotions and how music can just pull at a loose thread of emotion in you, or can just, you know, if you're really happy and you're putting on this really happy music, it just, it makes that happiness feel that much bigger and it just outside of yourself almost. And I also wanted to mention, like, the importance of music to human culture, in addition to, like, just, like, emotionally, like, how it affects us. And it's an important way that people, like, with ritual, people use music with ritual all the time. Yeah. It's a very ingrained, especially, like, we think of, like, religion when you think rituals, but, like, just any cultural thing, like, when you have a big get-together or something, you always have music, either a live band or a DJ. When you go to weddings, music is a huge part of all of that. So, like, it's just ingrained.
Sports games, like...
Absolutely, yeah. Like, it's just ingrained in every part of our culture. And I think we sometimes, you know, people like different artists or different genres, and you let it affect your, like, thought of how you think about that person. You think it's silly sometimes or whatever, but, like, everybody has their own music taste, and it all is really just the magic of music in general. And it just, anyway, not that we don't have enough to talk about with this, but
music, but did feel important.
Music being magic is a very interesting concept, and something I hope someone writes a book about someday. I feel like there's a lot of fantasy where music is important.
Yeah, and I was going to say...
Daniel Jose
Older. Yeah, that was a huge part of that.
Oh, yeah. That's but, like, cool. I feel like there's just so... It's such an untapped well that someone can just dig in deep and... Anyway, we'll let someone else do that right now. I don't have time. Okay, so Graceland is completely empty of tourists and security, which is really weird, and Carter, like, mentions it a couple of times, and Sadie says she thinks it's gotta be a Thoth thing, like, he's emptied it out for them, so that's not a part of the challenge. That's not why he's asked them to do this. We learn that Julius brought Carter here before. Carter talks a lot about having been there by himself. As they approach the front doors to the house at Graceland, the doors open all by themselves, and Carter makes a point to be like, that's not a great sign. Like, this is, something's off, something's weird. And at that moment, two magicians come running up the driveway with staffs and wands in hand. So Sadie and Carter duck inside of the house to get out of view and to figure out where they're going, what they're doing. They know they're on the hunt for an item from the grave of a magician. So now they have to figure out what they're looking for and where it's hiding. Just so we can keep them straight, one magician has a cowboy hat and the other is bald. So I basically refer to them as Cowboy and Baldy until we get their names in a little bit. So we'll kind of keep them separate as that for now. So Cowboy morphs his staff into a shotgun and blasts Elvis's front door to pieces.
Seems very unnecessary.
Right?
Just
like
saying.
It's destructive for all the wrong reasons. Like, why is this a thing? Carter and Sadie run through the house at that point because they're just trying to stay out of the magician's line of fire. They run through the kitchen, they run through a couple of rooms, and they end up in the jungle room. And Elvis decorated it that way to annoy his dad, which we find out from Carter and Sadie thinks is accurate and hilarious. Carter then tells Sadie, we need to split up. He doesn't really give her a chance to disagree with him. He sends her toward the trophy room because he really believes that whatever Thoth is looking for is probably in the trophy room. And he runs off, is still in sight of Sadie, though, And she sees him raise his sword and begin to kind of glow with this golden light. So he's clearly accessing Horus's power, or his own power, and is going to use magic. And before he can really do anything, this emerald flash strikes him and brings him to his knees. And she watches as Carter's entire being, clothes, sword, and everything, melts down into what she calls a tiny emerald sliver, which we quickly learn is a lizard. And Carter runs to Sadie, up her leg, into the palm of her hand, and she just looks at him like, thanks a lot.
Yeah. This part was so funny to me, because I was like, what type of lizard? There's a lot of different types of lizards.
You can't just say lizard.
Yeah. And I was like annoyed for like 2 seconds because I really wanted to know. But then I was like, I mean, if Sadie doesn't know what kind of lizard it is, like, she's not going to be able to name it.
Right.
But yeah, I was just like, I don't know. What kind?
Come on, Rick. And then it's like, all right. Sadie's not a lizard expert. She just, you know, it's fine. It's fine, I guess. So Sadie stuffs Carter in her pocket and runs off to avoid getting caught by the magicians. They continue blasting their way through Graceland.
That's a sentence.
It's so unnecessary.
Yeah.
She makes it to the trophy room, and the trophy room is full of all kinds of trophies. We're talking gold records, rhinestone Elvis jumpsuits that are encased in glass so that people can walk through and see them. The music playing in the background is Blue Suede Shoes, which is kind of why this chapter gets its title, clearly. As she's, like, looking around, taking this all in, the magicians close in on her. So Sadie goes into her bag and grabs her staff. Isis tries, at this point, to convince Sadie to let her take the reins and that she will deal with these two magicians, but Sadie refuses to let that happen. Sadie then remembers Zia's advice to use whatever you have available, and she just kind of takes quick stock of what's going on in the room, and she noticed when she first entered that the lights are dim in this room, so she decides to use the darkness to knock the vision for these magicians out of the situation. Like, if they can't see me, they can't get me. Like, that's, you know, gotta be a place to start anyway. Yeah.
I love the way that Rick is approaching how they are in their battles and, like, learning to use the magic, because clearly they are kind of inherently talented. They have that magic in them. And, like, they're smart kids, but it's also not just like, oh, I feel like they get lucky. And they also, like, her thinking back to, like, Zia's advice and, like, you know, use what's around you and, like, be observant. Like, she's kind of taking, like, they've had these lessons and she's remembering what she learned during those lessons, and, like, part of it's luck, part of it is just being, like, quick thinking, and it doesn't feel like, it just feels very natural to me in, like, a realistic way somebody would kind of approach this chaotic situation that they're in right now.
I absolutely agree. I remember reading this sentence, the use whatever you have available advice, and thinking, that is completely, like, common sense.
Yeah.
Like, you use what's at hand. But when you're a brand new magician being told you have power and that you have a goddess inside you full of power, your first thing is, what's powerful that I can use against them? Mm-hmm. And if you're standing in a dark room and you're like, oh, I know what's powerful in the darkness, light, and you try and blast light at these two magicians, it's not going to have the same effect that just darkening the room around you would have. Like, I like the advice kind of narrows the scope for these two amateur magicians at this point. It narrows the scope to, like, okay, what's going on around me? How can I make this situation work for me? Like, it doesn't let them go wild with the abilities. Like, I'm a magician. I can do anything. What can I do here? I'm going to blast them. Like, no. Just something simple like darkening the room gives you the advantage. And then you can work with the rest of your magic from there.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I think it's very common sense. It's very, like, it's centering. It's not like, go wild, go hog wild with all these abilities you have now.
Her resisting, immediately leaning on Isis's power is, like, tells you a lot about Sadie and kind of reflects, like, what she had been arguing with Thoth all along, which that she is in control and that she can keep the control.
Absolutely. But not only did she darken the room, she stopped the music the lights flicker off. Even the sunlight from outside fades until the room is completely black. This is when we get names that pop out of nowhere. So the two magicians are named Wayne and Jared. Wayne is the cowboy, mm-hmm. and Jared is the bald guy. Sadie uses her magic to call upon Elvis's jumpsuits to defend the house, and it's a very McGonagall.
Yes.
With the suits of armor.
I didn't think about that, but you're absolutely right.
Yeah, like, it's cute, and it's a funnier version of that, but it's very McGonagall suits of armor moment for me, and I was like, yes, that's hilarious. I love it. So there were four jumpsuits in the room. Two go to each magician to attack them, and it gives Sadie a chance to kind of figure out what she's going to do next. Isis tries to convince Sadie to kill and destroy, not just kill, but, like, turn to ash Jared while he's down, while the suits are beating him up. But Sadie chooses instead to just keep moving and get out of the situation. She bursts through a door and out into Graceland's backyard, like, behind the house. And there she sees Elvis's tomb, which is instantly, she sort of gets this feeling that that's where she needs to be. That's where the item they're looking for is. It makes it obvious because we literally knew they were looking for Elvis's grave, but, like, it didn't occur to them that the item would be specifically, like, right there. Just as Sadie starts to head toward the tomb, Baldy pops out the door, and Jared, Baldy, shoots a shot of green light from his staff. So now we know that he's the one who hit Carter before, because it's that same, like, emerald light. Sadie deflects it with her wand, and that green energy turns a pigeon into a lizard mid-flight, and it falls at Sadie's feet. And I just thought that was an interesting, like, aside that Rick wanted us to know which of these magicians was kind of doing which, I think. Like, he gives us the name and all of that.
That poor pigeon, you know, all of a sudden has the power of flight, and now it's a lizard. Like, right. That's got to be wild.
It's going to be a world changer for that pigeon, that's for sure. Jared throws his staff down on the ground, and it changes into a Komodo dragon, which is the size of a London taxi.
Love that we got the specifics on this one.
I don't know if you've ever seen a Komodo dragon.
Yes.
It is a one-of-a-kind creature.
Yeah.
I worked at the Toledo Zoo when it had its Komodo dragon exhibit, and so I know a lot about Komodo dragons because I had to learn quite a bit just from being around them all the time. And, like, they are fascinating creatures.
They are really, really interesting.
Just so cool, and, like, there's all kinds of fun facts about them and whatnot, but they are massive, powerful, like, absolutely insane creatures.
And it being the size of a London taxi is, I mean,
they're already big
and scary enough, like, that I would not want to mess with.
Absolutely not. So before Sadie can really do anything about this Komodo dragon, it's on her, and she just has enough time to shove her staff into its mouth and, like, wedge it open to keep it from biting her, probably literally in half. She senses that her staff isn't going to hold out that long, so Sadie decides to channel just a little bit of Isis's strength. And the goddess in that moment opens up, like, options for Sadie, and Sadie is able to take a moment to look at all the options that Isis is giving her. She chooses the simplest one and channels the power through her staff as she's got her hand on it in this Komodo dragon's mouth, and it grows hot. The dragon hisses and gurgles and then explodes in a shower of kindling, and it is gone. Jared is a little stunned as he watches his Komodo dragon staff just absolutely splinter into nothing. Sadie then chucks her wand at him, hits him in the forehead, knocks him out, and then her wand returns to her hand. So Jared is now, like, you know, on the floor, knocked out, thank goodness. But at that exact moment, Cowboy Wayne comes stumbling out the door. He uses wind to fly her staff out of her hand and to his, and he mentions that elemental magic will always be quicker than, like, elaborate magician, you know, elaborate spell work or whatever, which I thought was interesting.
I thought it was interesting that, like, that was pointed out very specifically.
Right. It feels important to know.
Yeah.
To keep a note of, for sure. The magician uses both Sadie's staff and his to strike the ground, and the ground almost does like a wave, almost like water, but like in the ground, and it knocks Sadie to her hands and knees. It's at that moment that Sadie remembers Zia using a trick with rope, and Isis suggests this command, this toss command, and Sadie yells it with this small, like, piece of twine that she pulled out of her backpack, and a golden hieroglyph burns in the air over Cowboy Wayne's head. Soon that twine just starts wrapping itself around Wayne's body and just lengthening itself until he is completely wrapped in a rope cocoon. Isis wants Sadie again to finish him off, and Sadie settles for cutting off Wayne's calls for fire, water, and cheese with one word. She just says silence, and he is done. He can no longer speak. So then Sadie takes a moment and she starts visualizing Carter as a human boy, and she's trying to bring him out of this lizard form and is successful. And I just think that alone, like, knowing how much trouble she had coming out of kite form,
yeah,
being able to kind of project that onto Carter for him is fascinating to me. Like, is that like an Isis ability? Like, it's Sadie's power, but I'm curious if, like, that's related to Isis's abilities or if that's a Sadie ability or something.
Isis is a healer. Like, that's one of the main things that she's known for, so maybe this was, like, her way of healing him of that spell that he was dealing with.
But it just definitely interesting, especially with how easy she seems to, like, it's not easy, but, like, she doesn't struggle with how to do it. She knows that if she can visualize him as a human and really, like, let that ground itself, that he'll come out of the lizard form.
Mm-hmm.
Carter pops up and is fully there, and he notices that Wayne and Jared don't seem to be entirely well anymore. They both have these, like, blank looks on their faces, and there's this ball of fire that's working its way out of both of their mouths. And Sadie kind of panics. She, you know, she made the choice not to hurt either of them any more than she had to.
Yeah.
And so you can tell that she's got this moment of panic where she thinks that Isis is working, you know, without her saying no, like, Isis has overpowered her. But no, it has nothing to do with that. They're both Shabti, they're made of clay, and this was a test from Thoth. It had to have been. Like, there's no, like, true, they don't have proof or anything, but it's clear to Carter, at least, that it has to have been a test from Thoth. Since both of their aggressors are gone, they take a second to really just look at what's going on around them, and they both feel really bad about the damage done to Graceland. And Sadie remembers another spell. She says "Hi Nem," and another golden floating glyph appears, and everything in the house, like, repairs itself. It, like, glows and shakes a little and does its thing. And Carter makes a point to say, like, I wonder if that included everything inside, too. And, like, Sadie doesn't really even question it. Like, I think she just believes, like, yeah, everything is repaired, which is interesting and fun. Okay, so at that point, it proves to be too much magic for Sadie, and her knees buckle. And Carter immediately says, like, you just did a lot. Like, it's okay that you're worn out now. Like, gives her permission to be weak in this moment. And then he sees a necklace on Elvis's grave. It's an Ankh symbol pendant with a small papyrus scroll attached to the chain. The paper has a picture of the Cat of Ra fighting Apophis. They have this discussion about how it's been a point of interest for a lot of people who the Cat of Ra actually is, and, like, there's a lot of options, and people have talked over the ages about who actually is the one to fight Apophis in this scene especially, but both of them think that the cat looks a lot like Muffin, mm-hmm, and that this has definitely got to be Bast. And I just thought it was hilarious that they both kind of, like, at the same time almost are like, that looks like Muffin to me. We know that the Cat of Ra defeated Apophis over and over again. It wasn't like a one-time battle. The Cat of Ra had to continue to defeat him time and time and time again, which I just, again, needs to be noted. If this is the note that's attached, the thing that Thoth told them to find, it's going to be significant at some point.
Right, yeah. And you could tell, like, thinking back on Bast and her questioning, like, this doesn't sound like Set, something else is going on. She kind of got an inkling that, okay, maybe this is Apophis.
Yeah.
Maybe my time to do something about right. this coming up. And, like, how is she going to feel about that, you know? Like, is that scary for her? Or is it just something she has to do?
Is it business as usual at this point?
Yeah.
Or is every time a huge, you know, she's to that point in her journey this time again. And it's
right.
like, okay, here we go.
Yeah, so I'm very interested to see how this plays out.
Absolutely. And just like that, another dark doorway opens and they are headed back to Thoth. And that is the end of this chapter. Whew. That was, again, it's another long chapter, but the action helps that one keep moving.
Yeah.
It just, this pair of chapters was...
less information in this one than
yes.
the last one.
Yeah. A lot more action, which is just fun. Okay, so we've got our favorite lines and our favorite moments. I will let Karen go first yet again. What is your line?
Mine was when Carter says, "The jungle room, he decorated it like this to annoy his dad." And Sadie replies, "I can respect that."
Right. It's very in Sadie's wheelhouse to
yeah.
have that reaction. Doesn't surprise me at all. Mine is literally the last line of the chapter. I very much appreciated Carter's response to everything they just went through and says, "Come on, I've got some questions for Thoth, and then I'm going to punch him in the beak." And then our favorite moments, what was yours?
All the reptiles. I just really loved seeing them. I'm a reptile girl now, apparently, because that's a thing, but yeah.
Prior to meeting Kevin, I would have called you maybe a cat person.
Yeah.
You know, you were dogs too.
I've always loved all animals, but like now because of him, I know more about reptiles than probably the average person. And that, like, you know, learning more about something always like makes me more interested in them. So it's really fun to...
It's cute. I love it. My favorite moment was Sadie shocking Jared by exploding his staff into kindling. It just... he hadn't yet seen how powerful she was. Like, the darkness, he didn't know where it came from.
Right.
Him and Wayne, or Wayne and Jared actually blamed each other for it, and they were like, "It wasn't me."
Yeah.
But, like, watching him just see her doing that, it was just a cool, cool moment. Prophecy Radio is produced by Subjectify Media. You can contact Prophecy Radio directly on Instagram at Prophecy Radio Podcast or email us at prophecyradiopodcast@gmail.com. You can find us and our episodes on Spotify, Apple, or any of your favorite podcast platforms. Please consider leaving us a review or a rating. 5-star reviews help others to find us, and that is such a big help. You can leave us questions, comments, ideas in either of these two places. We love hearing from you guys. We don't have any feedback this week, but we will definitely keep our eyes out for any messages from you guys for next time. Next time, we will be talking about the Red Pyramid chapters 25 and 26. You can expect that episode probably somewhere around the beginning of May. We'll be excited to keep the story going, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Until then, this is Kristen.
And I'm Karen.
And we're Prophecy Radio signing off. Over and out.